Rated R. It contains violence, adult language, nudity, and adult content.
I don't know if we have any nudity, but thanks for joining us anyway. And welcome, everybody. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesday, June 9th, 2021. And thank you for joining us for the 110th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during this show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you very much for that. And if you don't mind, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Okay, well, excuse me. That was a song written and done by Graham Nash, previous of Holly's fame and, of course, as Crosby, Stills, Nash and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young fame. That was his a song from his first solo record after the initial disbanding of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Excuse me, the first of many of disbandings and coming back togethers. And it was a solo record called Songs for Beginners. And the song off that record that everybody knows that, you know, got a lot of radio airplay was called Military Madness, and that was a big top 40 hit. That was a tune that I just played, was called Be Yourself, which is obviously about somebody listening to their own inner voices and you know, claiming themselves independent of whatever other folks might do or say or whatever, and to remembering what they stand for in their core. And given our topic tonight, I thought that was a good little intro for us.
Yes, definitely fitting. So that was well done, as always. As Dr. Mathis mentioned, tonight's episode is entitled, We're Not Going to Take It. Yes, that's a pan to Twisted Sister. Your Own Truth, which we will discuss in a moment. Before we begin our topic discussion, though, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Yeah, so I thought I'd do kind of another deep cut tonight, since I seem to be on a deep cut roll, and I'm not talking jelly. So, Yeah, of course. So most people, of course, when you talk about rock bands, you know, most people think, as do I have to confess, of guys, right? It's like, you know, you mostly associate harder, particularly harder edge rock bands, you know, with males. But as many of you know, there have been female bands in the past who have really sort of paved the way, despite cliches and biases and prejudices, which were very, very heavy in the 60s and 70s. You know, frequently I hear in interviews with females, and I still hear that today, that people will say things like, oh, that's really great for a chick. And I'm thinking, no, it's either good or it isn't. And the fact that a female is playing it versus a male makes no difference. The person's either talented or they're not. But it just, you know, shows to go, yeah, as I like to say, of the kind of biases we still kind of have to this day. I mean, and I still hear that kind of stuff going around, and I just sort of shake my head and go, okay, you're an idiot. Anyway, most of you, when I talk about girl bands, and I'm not talking about bands that are led by females or have a female presence of note, like Quarterflash, for example, or Heart, for an example, which most people will think of, you know, or Susie Quattro, who led a band, you know, who had a band back in the day, or Kiki D, or any of these folks who had top 40 and or rock-oriented hits. You know, most people, if they have any semblance to themselves, they'll think of things like The Runaways, which is one of the first popular all-girl bands that, from out of which came people like Joan Jett, right, who was the rhythm guitar player and vocalist in the band, and people like Lita Ford, who was the lead guitar player vocalist, both of whom have had very good careers. Lita Ford, more hard rock, hard edge rock, and glam rocky of the 80s, and Joan Jett, more of a punk rocker, but still very legitimate folks. What people have probably not heard is there were two original girl bands that signed originally to major labels. One was called the Pleasure Seekers. The other one was called Goldie and the Gingerbreads, which I thought was very interesting.
Whoa.
But, yeah, I know. I haven't heard of either one of these.
That's fascinating.
I'm a nerd. What do you expect, right?
No, that's why we do this segment, so we can learn things.
Yeah, well, there you go. Right, I'm good for something. Then you put me back in my box till the next show. One of the bands that has gotten more accreditation, although certainly not the accreditation they probably deserve, was a band called Fanny, which was an all-girl band, and the name had nothing to do with a female anatomy. It was given to them actually by the person who signed them, because they were originally called something else, and I don't actually remember what the heck their original name was. Something like Wild Honey. That was the name of the band. God, I can't believe I remember that. So the name of the band originally was Wild Honey. And, you know, sometimes people will then also, you know, in later years, they'll name people like the Go-Go's and, you know, and the Bangles and that sort of thing. But every single one of these girl bands that I mentioned, including folks that aren't girls like David Bowie, although sometimes one wonders depending on the outfit he's wearing. But, you know, people like David Bowie and very well-known rockers, you know, Earl Slick, and a lot of just very well-known folks have said, you know, Todd Rundgren have said, holy moly, these chicks could rock. They weren't just, you know, they weren't just pretty faces, so to speak, that these were serious musicians and have not really gotten the credit they deserve. Keith Richards being another one that really was inspired by these. But a lot of these guys and gals will tell you they were inspired by these folks. And so what happened is back in the day, there was a pair of sisters originally from the Philippines who moved to California, June and Jean Millington. And Jean was the bass player and vocalist, and June was the lead guitarist and vocalist. And then they had two of the members, Alice DeBeer on drums and Nikki Barkley on keyboards. All four sang. The predominant vocalists were June, Jean, and Nikki. But they were signed to Warner Brothers, still known as Wild Honey, before they moved to Reprise Records. And Richard Perry saw them, who was a promoter, and actually his secretary was this guy who was a promoter and a producer. They were doing open mic gigs trying to get acknowledged, and they were so sick of all the BS they were getting that they did this last open mic thing at the Troubadour Club, which most people who know anything about the LA scene know that's a very hot club for bands to be, you know, quote-unquote discovered. And Richard Perry's secretary happened to be at the gig and knew that Richard was looking for an all-girl band to promote, and she goes back to Richard and said, you need to go to these guys, these gals and sign them. And that's how they got signed. On the gig, they were about to toss it all in. They were going to disband after this open mic at the Truman Door. So I thought that was a very interesting turn of events, and I guess you just never know. So they got signed, and Perry actually produced their first three records. And I think the first record was in 90, not 91. It was in 1990. And they were basically only together about 4 or 5 years. I think they broke up right before their last record in April of 75. A lot of the breaking up was just due to all the pressure they were getting from the record labels and people discounting them as musicians and wanting them to dress, you know, seductively. And they're like, no, go screw yourself. We're not buying for that female bullshit. We're not doing the, you know, what you think girls ought to look like kind of thing. And you know, kudos to them for doing that. But in their career, you know, they covered some tunes. They actually did Hey Bulldog by the Beatles, which is a really deep cut, and they do a good job of it. They covered a version of Cream's Badge, and really, you know, which, you know, they're not a Ain't That Peculiar, which is a Motown hit. And they described themselves at the time of being sort of this combination of Motown meets rock, and that they were influenced by both, you know, sides of that coin, so to speak. And post the original breakup, they've come back together with different constellations of members. One of the gals left to go to study Buddhism because she felt totally, you know, isolated, didn't know what to do. The guitarist, June Millington, went to Woodstock and actually became a Buddhist to study Buddhism and just kind of get away from their stuff. Their last record, which I think, the fourth record, excuse me, which was I think in 73 or 74, I don't remember which, was actually produced by Todd Rundgren, you know, which most people really, really know. Yeah. You know, and during their time together, you know, people like Little George of Little Feet, and I mentioned David Bowie, was, and that's really the correct way to pronounce his name if you're in England. Was
very. I was wondering, because earlier you said it the other way, and I was like, I thought you corrected me on that.
No, it's Bowie, but I just said Bowie because everybody would go, who is that? So I said it the way everybody knows, and then I pronounced it correctly. So yeah, you got it right.
Okay.
And it was really funny because he's done interviews with Rolling Stone magazine and basically talking about them, said, you know, they were extraordinary musicians. They wrote everything. quote unquote, they played like motherfuckers. It's just a David quote. They were colossal and wonderful, and nobody's ever mentioned them. And they're as important as anybody else who's ever been, ever. It just wasn't their time. And that's a David Bowie comment. And a lot of folks, including his guitar player, Earl Slick, who was Bowie's guitar player, who Gene Millington was married to for a while, mm-hmm. Said, this band was phenomenal. I mean, what the hell? Well, what's happened in later years is they've kind of come back into the public eye, and I think it was oh my God, I just called his name earlier and I'm having a anomia moment. I call him Mummy Boy because he looks like a mummy, no offense to him. Keith Richards.
Because
he smoked cigarettes, his skin looks like a mummy. He's been smoking for so long, although somebody told me he'd finally quit, and I'm like, okay, I'll believe it when I see it. But he's been smoking for a long time, and he looks all dried up, but anyway, I think he has. That was not a slam. That's a description. He has really done a lot of marketing for this, folks. And there is for 3 years, there was a a bio film done of them called The Right to Rock that's going to get released or has just gotten released this year that kind of documents the band. And my understanding is they have been offered a recording deal again, and now they're in like their 70s or 80s, and I just think it's hilarious.
Wow.
And it just shows to go, as I like to say, that, you're never too old to rock. And, speaking of which, look at Keith Richards, and again, no offense to him their lead singer, Mick Jagger, because both of those guys are just, pounding it out and more power to them. I mean, people like Jimmy Page and a lot of folks are out there, Klaus Meine of Scorpions. I mean, those folks are still doing it. They still sound awesome. And I just think it's great. And I think it's awesome that all these people are coming back and doing their thing. And some of the folks have never left. Clapton's still doing this thing. Aerosmith. I mean, I love that they're defying societal role models and stereotypes, which is what Fanny did. And now that's like society's kind of like matured, if you will, no pun intended, it's like, okay, well, hey, these folks were actually pretty good. Maybe they should come back and do some more stuff. So I just think it's kind of interesting how they might actually be getting a second career in their, later years. And I've seen videos of this band. I never got to see this band. I mean, they appeared on Don Kirshner's, rock show back in the 70s. And, I've seen them as a kid. I've seen videos of them. I just didn't know who they were at the time. And I'm like, oh, those chicks can play. Holy shit, And then I got really caught up in bands like Heart, and who I just absolutely love to this day. And that's another group of folks, Ann and Nancy Wilson, who can still belt it out like nobody's business. But these were gals, I'm like, holy shit, they're playing Fender amps and Gibson guitars and, Fender basses. And I'm like, holy shit. And their keyboard player, Nikki Barkley. I mean, you go back and look at those videos. She is no slouch. That chick can play keyboards like crazy. It's just like, wow. I mean, not that any of them are slouches, but I was particularly impressed listening to some of the keyboard stuff in the back of that, where she's playing both piano and Hammond B3. It's just, I used to go back. I encourage listeners who don't know these folks, even though they'll listen to some of their stuff and go, hey, that stuff's a little dated. Yeah, it might be a little dated, but go back and think about both your late 60s, early to mid 70s skullcap on, so to speak. And it's not dated at all, and those folks can play. They are definitely not schleppers. And, folks who don't know of them, I would highly recommend going back, because all of the girl bands that the Bangles, the Go-Go's, the Runaways, all those folks, they all cite this band as a huge influence to them.
Oh, that's good to know.
Right. So, word to your mother. go back if you don't know these folks, go back and check them out and purchase their stuff and, you know, rock on, because rock knows no gender, no color, no age, no race. It's an equal opportunity rock and roll machine. So go out there and do your thing and support your local music, especially now that this crap is almost fading away, hopefully.
Yes, yes, good. And that's all very timely for what we're going to talk about tonight, you know, not letting stereotypes run you and just do your business.
Well, that was the only reason I picked them. I thought, and it was really kind of a coincidence, because I was reminded by their presence by an ad I saw about the video coming out, the bio coming out. And I thought, oh, this is great. And I went, hey, wait a minute, this is related. Ha! That was kind of one of those delayed aha reactions. So there you go,
perfect
folks.
Timing. Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you very much for that, as always.
Sure.
Let's get some thank you for that. All righty. That was fabulous, as usual. And we will take calls from our listeners through the remainder of the show until around midnight, and questions in the online chat room if you want. So feel free to give us a call or log in to the website. The number for calling into the board is 914-338-0314. Okay, tonight's episode is called We're Not Gonna Take It, Your Own Truth. Now, tonight's show title might be a little vague. I was attempting to incorporate a relevant rock song title, but it seemed to be a bit brief to properly cover tonight's topic. When you post the episode on the website, you have a character limit, so I couldn't really quite get to my point in the number of characters I had left. So let's talk about what we're going to talk about. So we want to talk about being true to yourself, as well as looking at how to know when you are on the right path versus self-delusion. This is not really a pathology, unless, of course, you are delusional in some way. That's a whole different speech. But it can be a mental health issue for many people, especially if what seems to be truly in your heart and spirit is contradicted or not accepted by your community, your peers, or society in general. We have done a couple of shows in the past that may also be helpful listening to those who are considering this topic. One of them was a very early cut for us, which was episode 5, which was critical thinking skills. And I highly recommend that you guys go listen to this, because critical thinking skills are critical to this and navigating what is really in your heart, because you have to be able to pick things apart. And that came out on September 21st, 2016. The link is on our Facebook page, or message me if you can't find it and I'll get it to you. And the second episode that seems relevant is episode 34, which was entitled Take the Power Back. It was originally going to be November 15th of 2017. We ended up postponing it for reasons. So it was November 29th, 2017. And basically that was about not letting other people run you, which is also a part of tonight's discussion. So check those out when you get a chance. Let me know if you can't find the links to do so. And tonight we're going to be discussing how people determine their sense of personal identity, why others sometimes find one's identity to be a threat, which is the main reason that people have something sassy to say about it, how to know if your sense of identity is false, toxic, delusional, or otherwise unhealthy, and how to develop a strong sense of self-identity in the face of criticism or pressure to change. And before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything you want to bring up before we dive in.
Nope, I'm good. Thank you.
All righty. So let's jump right ahead. So first part we want to talk about is how people determine their sense of personal identity. And we want to make sure we're all on the same page with this. So self-identity and one's sense of self, you know, related concepts, is a concept that most people in our society have heard of, but many don't really know how to describe it or develop their own intentionally. So let's begin by talking about the basics of this concept so that our listeners have a foundation on which to build their understanding. So let's look at some articles on this concept to help describe the idea and the process. It's actually just a couple articles that I picked out. This is the main one that I drew from. And it's entitled, Who Am I? How to Find Your Sense of Self. It was written by Crystal Raypole on June 17, 2020, and then clinically reviewed by clinical psychologist Alex Klein, PsyD, for Healthline.com. And they say in this article, your sense of self refers to your perception of the collection of characteristics that define you. Personality traits, abilities, likes and dislikes, your belief system or moral code, and the things that motivate you, these all contribute to self-image or your unique identity as a person. People who can easily describe these aspects of their identity typically have a fairly strong sense of who they are. Struggling to name more than a few of these characteristics might point to a less defined sense of self. You may not spend much time consciously thinking about your identity, but it still affects your life. Knowing who you are allows you to live with purpose and develop satisfying relationships, both of which can contribute to overall good emotional health. Self-knowledge makes it easier to accept your entire self, both the traits you're proud of and those that maybe you'd like to improve. If you do feel dissatisfied with certain aspects of yourself, you'll have an easier time addressing those areas when you have a strong sense of your nature and abilities. Lacking a clearly defined sense of self, on the other hand, often makes it tough to know exactly what you want. If you feel uncertain or indecisive when it comes time to make important choices, you may end up struggling to make any choice at all. As a result, you might simply drift through life, carried by other people and circumstances rather than your own momentum. This often leads to discontent, even when nothing specific seems wrong and you can't identify the source of your unhappiness. And close quotes there. I quote some more from it later, and I'll let you know when those sections are, not my own writing. So this article raises some critical points. A sense of self and identity affects most of your everyday choices and major life choices. It is one way in which we are actively mutual with others and build a sense of community and belonging with those with whom we share some preferences. You hear people talk about, these are my people, these are my tribe, or whatever. And that's kind of the sentiment that they are grasping for. Ideas, history, experiences, beliefs, or traits. These are the things you might have in common with these people that bond you together. And it is neurotypical for most people to strive to foster a sense of belonging and connection, whether with other people, places, activities, or events. We often long for the feeling of home and family, whether it is the one with which we started life or one we create along the way based on inclinations that are part of this self-identity. And side note here, that's not actually in my script. I do know that there are people, and it's not super rare. There are quite a few people who don't really want to go back home or connect to family. And pretty close to always, or at least the majority of the time when you see that, it's because this opportunity to be mutual and belong and be acknowledged of the tribe was destroyed or spoiled or ruined for them at some point early on. And that usually drives them away from it. So you don't see that in people when they have the opportunity to have those things. So I just wanted to point that out. Identity helps us choose goals, both small and large, short and long term. We may gravitate towards activities and people that grow or improve aspects we value, or we may even lean towards some that help us process or correct some traits that do not serve us well, or at least not anymore. And at this point, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything you'd like to add.
For folks who don't have a good sense of identity, or they think they might not have a good sense of identity or don't know how to find it, one resource for them, if they're interested, that I often use with a lot of my patients who are struggling with that, is a book called Soul Catcher by Kathy Eldon, Amy Eldon, That's a mother and sister who lost their brother. I think he was like 22 or 23. He was a photojournalist on assignment in Somalia, and he was killed there. And they sort of wrote that as sort of a way to help them grieve and find out who they were, and you know, and outside of their identity as a sister and mother and that sort of thing. But it's a really, really good book, and it's sort of a self-help journey, and it's really I highly recommend it to people who are struggling with that. And it's still published to this day. You can find it in most bookstores, on Amazon, whatever. So folks who are looking for something to help guide them, it's a really good step-by-step kind of guiding tool, and I would really encourage folks to use that if they don't have a sense of identity or if they're trying to form one.
Excellent. Good to know. Well, you know, hopefully you guys can pick that up. If you have trouble finding it, message the page and we will get you the hookup. So, all right, let's go ahead and go to section two. And that is why others sometimes find one's identity to be a threat. And we want to talk about this part because, as I mentioned earlier, this is pretty close to always why people are pushing back and they can't just let you be whatever you're being. It's because somehow you are a threat to them. They think you're a threat to them. So we have discussed in other episodes on this show how people still retain vestiges of the primal instinct to be wary of or even attack anyone who is perceived as other somehow, and that it is a primitive response that no longer serves a modern civilization most of the time, but the habit of resorting to it must actively be unlearned. Many people do not know this about humans or about themselves, and they still engage in what we now call knee-jerk reactions to things, allowing themselves to be manipulated by many forces in our culture, our media, and society, each with its own goals and agendas. Opinions are not personal identities, but, as we mentioned earlier, one's identity forms the basis for how many opinions are made. One's culture or extended circle can validate various beliefs, and if we are not meticulous about verifying them as fact or debunking them, we can form opinions out of our own identity that could be inaccurate and harmful. We believe we are doing this to protect ourselves from bad things that we believe could happen to us because of allowing the presence of someone who is other in some way. Learning how to self-examine your own beliefs, interests, and opinions, and always being open and willing to question them many times over the years, requires a level of security in one's own self that can withstand changing and growing without feeling subsumed by the new ways. That isn't the default in our culture. So here we are with people too insecure to check and make sure they're correct before lashing out. And the main takeaway from this is to kind of understand, not to excuse. Let me be very crystal clear on that. We are not making excuses for anyone. But if we're going to make them stop attacking us for who we are, we need to understand that most of this is fear. We've talked about this on another show as well, about how a lot of lashing out comes from fear. You know, what motivates a lot of, you know, mass shooters and bigots and attackers and all this other stuff. You know, a lot of it is out of fear of the other. So this is a really, really huge theme. And if we're going to deal with other people pushing back on ourselves, we need to understand that they're afraid of something. And if you can get them to talk about it, get them to be willing to examine it, that's going to be how you get it to calm down. It's not your responsibility, but it is a tool you might need, and that's why we bring it up. All right, at this point, I'm going to check in with you again, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything else that you would like to say about this part.
Yeah, some of that's also due to groupthink and concrete reasoning, not being able to think outside the box and, you know, buying what you're told and not questioning the validity of what everybody else around you is saying and wanting to be part of the group and all that kind of stuff. So some of that is also into play as well. And that's true in almost every arena, even people that you might think are above that sort of thing, but we're all susceptible if we're not careful.
Yes, absolutely true. And we need to make sure also that when we're building our sense of self, that we're not also doing the same thing. You know, make sure that we've checked in on our own little, you know, the hill that we want to die on. Make sure it's actually built out of stone and not out of sand. You know, that's a euphemism, but you know what I'm saying here.
Yeah, absolutely.
All righty. So the next part that I want to talk about is, how do you know if your sense of identity is false, toxic, delusional, or otherwise unhealthy? Perfect segue to what we were just talking about. So this is a little bit longer than the other sections, but it breaks this apart so that you guys can learn how to do this for yourselves. If you haven't already picked it up in life, you know, there are some people who were never taught this. So school's in session, y'all. Grab a chair and a cold drink and pay attention. All right. The earlier article that we first quoted later had some advice on analyzing one's self-identity and how to determine whether a trait is true to oneself or just a habit or coping mechanism that one may have picked up for some reason ages ago. And again, the article is Who Am I? How to Find Your Sense of Self, Crystal Raypole in June 2020, reviewed by Alex Klein, and this is from Healthline.com. So this is what they have to say about that part of the process. Asking yourself the following questions below can offer some insight. Do I say yes to make others happy? And you know what they mean by this. If you're appeasing people, you know, whether it's you want them to like you or you're afraid they're going to get all cluster B in your face and then you're going to have to run away, don't want to make any drama, don't want to make them sad or disappointed or lots of other things that people do. You know, is that why you say yes to stuff? Next, ask, what are my strengths? They don't say this, but I might recommend if you really don't know, start with two or three friends that you're pretty close to or at least that you think have really good judgment. Ask them, and you actually might be pleasantly shocked to hear the answers. Maybe it's something you don't take that seriously and maybe you ought to, or that you don't realize that other people think is cool. That happens a lot too. The next one you can try is, what brings me happiness? And this could be activities, events, hobbies, work, people, places, lots of things. You know, what really makes you want to get up in the morning and go do that or be part of that or have that around you? And if you don't have anything, you might need to start with what doesn't bring you happiness, because that will form the outer circle around the thing that is the answer, even if you don't know what it is yet. Maybe if you get what it's not, you'll start to see it. Sometimes you have to go there to find it. The next question is, what are my values and do I live my life accordingly? It is a lot easier to say you have certain principles. It is a lot more difficult to regularly live by them. There's a lot of people who are very quick to do the first, not so quick to do the second. But figure that out, because that's going to color a lot of decisions. For example, in my case, over the years, through trial and error and a lot of bruises from people that I trusted, I have decided that I am really hardcore about honesty. And that does open me up to some answers I didn't want to know. I do want to know the information, but I'm upset at what the answer is. But I now come to know in myself that I don't want them to lie to me, even if the answer is really shitty. I just don't, because you base your decisions on what you think is the truth. And if you're being lied to, then you make decisions based on something that's not actually even happening. And that, at best, that can be embarrassing or a giant waste of time. At worst, it could be super harmful. So figure out what really matters to you, that you will die on this hill. I will not let go of this principle. And take a look at your life and see if you're in alignment with that, because you might be only halfway there. And that will help you in firming up your sense of identity when you have principles and you start choosing in your life out of those principles. So the next one is, do my choices reflect my own interests or someone else's? And, you know, this means, would you still choose those things if a particular person were not in your life? Like, maybe you are choosing them because of a partner or someone you want to impress or, you know, otherwise get a reaction or approval from, you know, maybe your parents or even your kids or something. You know, is it about that? If these people weren't here, would you still choose this stuff? This is a very important thing to know about yourself and what you're doing. Factors that can influence your sense of self, and this is also from the article. Say you had some trouble answering the questions above. Quote, who am I really? You might be wondering. This is not my beautiful house. perhaps with some distress. It might reassure you to learn it's not terribly uncommon to have a somewhat blurred sense of self. This doesn't mean you've done anything wrong or that you're destined to live out your life without a clear identity. A better understanding of the factors that play a part in the formation of self-image can help you begin sharpening it. And they have these little sections right here. First one is individuation. Individuation, or the process through which you develop a unique self, begins in childhood. To individuate successfully, children need room to explore, learn, and express needs and desires. Number two is attachment. And we talk a lot about, you know, attachment disorder and kids not bonding to the family properly or being rejected by the parents, you know, all this. When you don't feel certain of your caregiver's unconditional love and acceptance, you might tailor your behavior to earn their approval. Kids do this to strict parents quite a bit. And then the problem is when they become adults, they don't stop. The resulting praise and affection reinforce the belief that modeling yourself to fit the expectations of others is the best, perhaps only, way to succeed in relationships. This pattern usually continues to play out in your future relationships as you stifle your own needs in order to fulfill the needs of your partners, seeing this as the only way to hold on to their affection. And the last one is a desire to fit in. If you struggled to fit in with your peers in adolescence, and Jesus, I really don't actually even know any preteens and teens that didn't struggle with that. It's just that we thought some people never struggled, and then we found out when we're 30 and 40 that those people just struggled in a different way. And this is what we did to ourselves as kids, and then we don't get over it because we don't realize it's what we did until someone points at it. So I'm pointing. Pay attention. So you may have found it easier to take on the role of a social chameleon. Instead of holding on to your sense of self, you begin to shifting your identity to better fit in with multiple groups. You might take on a certain persona at work, another one with your family, and still another when you spend time with friends. Switching between these different selves can make it even more difficult to unearth your true nature and create stress for yourself. And that's the end quote of the article, and I have a comment here. I do want to expound on one point that Ms. Raypole made about being a social chameleon. So this is not always necessarily a behavior that subverts all authentic sense of self. I have a typo in here. I apologize. People change behaviors between work, family, friends, large groups of strangers, reunions with childhood friends, and so on. Some ways of being just simply are not appropriate for every single setting, which is about courtesy and respect, and it's not necessarily squelching oneself to cater to others. It's important that our listeners understand the difference, and I hope you guys know what I mean by this. You know, there's ways that you comport yourself in the workplace, and I'm pretty certain if you went out with your college buddies after work's done for the week, and y'all go to a bar, you're not going to act like you act in the office. This is not subverting yourself. What they're talking about is you just being what you think the group wants, whatever the group is. So you keep changing what you're being depending on who you're hanging with. That's kind of more what they mean. And I just want the difference to be clear, because there are times it's appropriate to change your behavior a little, but you got to know which one you're doing. And don't do the one where you just kiss up to who you're with. So the other part of my note says, in line with the original question of this segment, you must be willing to verify and question things. A well-reasoned and healthy identity trait should stand up to scrutiny. Never be afraid to hesitate and ask yourself, am I positive that this is true or healthy or appropriate? Does it harm or degrade others? Is it something I do or want for myself, or is it something to please someone else? Does it make me happy, safe, or satisfied in some way? These are all important things to consider. If the answers are no, you may be due for some change and growth. And Dr. Mathis, I'm looking to you now to see if there's anything you want to add.
Yeah, a lot of things I'll talk about with my folks, excuse me, particularly when I'm dealing with my adolescents, is, you know, I think it's important for you to be who you are, whatever that is, but make sure that when you're expressing your individuality that you don't step on somebody else's toes to do likewise, right? This has to be a balance. But your point about changing behaviors in different environments is a really important one. As the other thing I'll say to a lot of my folks is, you know, I'm not going to dress the same way in a courtroom that I'm being called in to testify that I would at an Aussie concert or vice versa, right? So if I show up in a three-piece suit with a tie and, you know, look all professional in a courtroom, well, that's the norm. That's expected behavior. I'm there to do a job. That doesn't change my inner core. I'm just adapting to the environment of expectation because I'm there to help somebody. If I go to an Aussie concert, I'm still the intellectual guy that I was in the courtroom. I'm just dressed in a T-shirt and jeans, right? But I'm still holding on to the core inside of me. And likewise, when I'm in the courtroom, I don't tell people, oh, yeah, I don't listen to that hard rock, long-haired crap. What the hell? You know? So how I do the me that's me, so to speak, will vary a little bit depending on the people I'm with and the environment I'm placing myself in or that I am placed in due to work or whatever. But I don't change who the core of me is in those environments, nor do I agree to things that I don't normally agree to when I'm in those environments. But at the same time, if I find myself at odds with someone else who believes differently than I do in an environment, excuse me, I have to ask myself, A, is it important for me to speak out, or are we just talking about differences of opinion here? And if I do speak out, like in board meetings or that kind of thing, like as I was in earlier today, because I'm on the addictions board here, you know, if I speak out in a way, can I do it in a way that doesn't tread on somebody else's stuff? Or do I even need to speak out? Can I just, you know, be quiet because other people are saying what they say and I think what they say is full of, you know, sheep dip? But, okay, they're not hurting anybody by their opinions, and so why am I going to want to voice mine and try to change theirs? What's that about me that feels the need to change these people to agree with me? I don't have that. And if they want to believe what I consider to be delusional beliefs, that's great. If they're not hurting somebody else, okay, they're entitled to do that. That's why we still live in a democracy and in America where we can feel and think as we want. But you have to be careful when you're speaking those things not to encroach on somebody else's boundaries. And you can do that in very respectful ways and still keep the core of who you are intact. You know, it's just, if you're asking other people to respect you and your boundaries, you have to be able to respect theirs and their rights to be autonomous and to be independent and to be an individual themselves. And sometimes that's a really tricky balance. And particularly for adolescents who are still developing the prefrontals and kind of feeling their way, that's kind of hard for them to do. And, you know, so I try to use, you know, examples in my own life with them and stuff that I do. And you know, sometimes it gets a little hairy, you know, but with me, that's okay because I've got a lot of hair to spare. So that's, but you know, so this is like, okay, how am I going to say this in a way they're going to hear me that doesn't seem like I'm slamming them, but then doesn't seem like I'm giving them carte blanche to go out and do, you know, crazy and antisocially things. So it's a balance for each too sometimes how I come across to these folks. And at the same time, you know, not freak out their parents at least too badly when I'm doing it. They usually get enough of a shock when they walk into the waiting room and see the guy with all the hair, and they're like, this big cognitive disconnect. Yeah, it's all this big cognitive disconnect, like, oh my God, please tell me this is not the guy who's going to work with my kids, right? So over the years, I've gotten a real charge out of that, as opposed to trying to conform my behavior by cutting my hair or tucking it into my shirt or acting like I don't have it or apologizing for it. And I'm like, no, and that's part of the reason I do it in the courtroom. I mean, when I testify in a courtroom, and my standing joke is I look like a doctor from the neck down. Now, my hair looks neat. It's not, you know, totally crazy, but I don't put it in a ponytail. I don't tuck it into my shirt. I mean, part of it is me being me, and part of it is, as David Crosby would say, letting my free flag fly. And let's face it, part of it is a passive-aggressive FU statement to society in general and to stereotypes. But I do it in a way that doesn't preclude somebody else from having a stereotype if they want. I'm just challenging it. That's all. And so, you know, it's what I do. And it's how you do that, I think, is really, really important if you're going to stick to your guns. And sticking to your guns is goes counter with the group you're hanging out with in whatever scenario, particularly if you are in there, as in my case, if I go into a courtroom to testify, I'm there being paid to do that, and, you know, for my expertise to represent somebody and to represent the truth. And I can't make them hear the truth if I'm too busy flaunting my free flag and rubbing stuff in people's faces. They're not going to hear me, you know. Yeah. So it's always a balance. It's a balance for me, and I've been doing this a long time. I still don't have it down. You know, I still make mistakes. I still mess up.
And that's important for people to realize, is that a lot of these things, you don't come to a final answer and then you're done when you're 25. That's not how it works.
No.
Yeah. Well, you know, that would be a correct statement. I want to get clear that expectation is not realistic, because I know that bad expectation drives a lot of people's shock when they're still navigating this at 40 and they think that they fucked up somehow, and they haven't, but they don't know. People don't know these things. That's
know.
Why we're here.
And that's part of the reason we do these shows, right?
Absolutely. All right. So let's get to the last section, which is how to develop a strong sense of self-identity in the face of criticism or pressure to change. So this section is likely the simplest to talk about, but the most difficult to execute. So to be able to stay strong to one's authentic self in the face of criticism, shame, slander, bullying, rejection, harassment, and so forth, requires the conviction of someone who has certainty, because they've given a lot of thought, introspection, and self-examination to their identity, and they feel certain enough of it to refuse to accept pressure to change it. I know that's a tall order for some people. I get it. Also, to be clear, we are assuming here that things pass the proverbial sniff test of Section 3 that we were just talking about, that these habits and beliefs are not toxic, harming oneself or others, and are authentic and not done to appease someone else. Because if you're running around being toxic and horrible to people, that's not you being your self-identity or whatever. That's you being toxic and horrible, and they have a right to fuss at you. So just be clear which one we're talking about here. One critical tool in surviving such pressure is to prepare oneself to possibly have to pull away from the people pushing you around. It may mean a break, cutting ties, issuing direct boundaries, if not full-on moratoriums of behavior, and generally being prepared to walk away at least for a time to consider and heal and maybe to grow. It's painful, but to not do this work allows others to use the threat of them walking out as a weapon to make you change or else. So being in control of that decision takes away power they have over you. So this is something that you can do to make it easier to stick to your guns. You know, cross that bridge, figure out where you are with it, and then they don't surprise you and they can't use it. Knowing yourself and what is deeply, authentically your truth is protection. If it's real, you can, in good conscience, not budge. And there might be some painful risks, but there is a comfort in knowing you did not allow anyone to bully you to live a lie. Sometimes it's a matter of great privilege to be able to do this, and we do recognize that. People may be socially or financially dependent on someone, like family members or a partner, and have to swallow some things to keep an uneasy peace. We understand, and we hope our listeners understand, such solutions are always temporary and often just erupt later on anyway. So, you know, if it has to come to that because you don't have a lot of choice, that's fine. You need to get that you're just kicking the can down the road. And eventually you're going to have to turn around and say, all right, no more. We're done. It may not be right now, but it's going to be one day. So you need to understand that. Figure out what you're going to do when that happens, because it's when, it's not if. The last thing I want to say is that would help is surround yourself in life with people and activities that make you feel heard, seen, and validated. There's always going to be some asshole that tells you you're wrong on the planet. You're never going to get to a point where no one says it. It doesn't make it true. It just means friends and family, they're a Venn diagram. There's always going to be outliers, but if you have really heavily examined your choices and the stands that you've taken, the ways you want to be, and they're not hurting people, and you're doing it for your own reasons, and you're really sure of it, bring the people in towards you that stand behind that. And the ones that don't, let them fade off to the edge. It may take time, but stop settling for less. You're not buying anything. If you want to grow your authentic sense of self, be comfortable in doing this. It will make you sad. It might make you angry and have little snips with people. But this is about getting clear about yourself and taking a stand for yourself in the spite of other people trying to talk you out of it. And that's what we're about tonight. So this is what you need to do to make that happen. And Dr. Mathis, it is your turn to expound.
No, I'm pretty good. I'm reminded as you were talking of the lyric to one of my favorite Cheap Trick songs, which is "Surrender, but don't give yourself away." That just came into my head for some reason.
Yes, that's very appropriate. Exactly what I was talking about. All right, so if that's pretty much what you want to add for that, then in summary, we hope that our listeners now better understand self-identity, forming yours and defending it. And we hope that we have better empowered you to be able to think through the process of knowing your own heart and mind and spirit and who our listeners really authentically are, as well as how to stand up for that identity and sense of self when it gets challenged. So this concludes our show. We're not going to take it, your own truth. Dr. Mathis, is there anything else that you want to add on any part of the show before we close?
I'm good, thanks.
All righty, cool. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and every evening, and give our appreciation also to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we will see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion Wednesday, June 23rd, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd like to also give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. Thursday, tomorrow night, Travelers Radio, that will be on the 10th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. When the Boston Red Sox are on the road, Fenway Park still swings to the sound of music. Very good dad joke there. Though more than a century old, the venerable ballpark has hosted some of the newest names in show business, plus countless others that are household names. Since the series began in 2003, the ballpark has been the musical home of Paul McCartney, Bruce Springsteen, and James Taylor, with Billy Joel and Lady Gaga headlining the 2021 schedule. Hear all about the concert series past and present on Thursday, June 10th, when Red Sox executives Larry Cancrow and Beth Curtis join Travelitch Radio for an interview with Dan Schlossberg and co-host Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee. Next is Sports Talk with the Guys Saturday Morning Extravaganza, 9 a.m. this Saturday. The Monday Morning Quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. The 13th of the month, next Sunday, not this coming, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Oh, pardon me, the 13th will be this Sunday. That's my bad. I got a little messed up because The Walking Dead took a hiatus for Memorial Day, and it was unannounced. So I actually ended up with a Sunday night show, and I didn't know it until an hour before I was supposed to go on the air. Good times, everybody. So Fear the Walking Dead online viewing party will wrap up Season 6 with the Episode 16 season finale, The Beginning. That's the title of it. Please join us online or on the air by phone for real-time discussions, updates, trivia, profiles on the cast and crew, and more. Mondays, 10 p.m. Monday Night in America with Roger Dean Noriega brings you his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. Following day, The Nightmare Hunter with Roger Noriega has moved to Tuesday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and that is hosted on Streamlabs, not on Blog Talk Radio. Tuesdays at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Fandom Access, Week in Review. Join the terrific trio of Jamie, Karen, and AJ as they dig into another night of TV. Please look for The Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us, and see you next time. Rock on. Good night.